Well, we are in the book of Exodus this morning, Exodus chapter 6, and we are going to be looking at verses 10 through 30, Exodus chapter 6, verses 10 through 30. You know, with little kids on the playground, a lot of scuffles develop when two simple words are said. Says who, right? One kid tells another kid to do something. They don't agree with his assessment of the situation, don't want to do it. And they say, says who? And a lot of times that's followed by make me, right? Them are fighting words. There may be perfectly legitimate reasons to tell somebody something to do, but there's also illegitimate reasons. The question really goes back to authority. Who gives one person the right to tell another person what to do? And experts have studied this out in a thousand different directions, and there's different types of authorities that you see, different types of coercion, and different reasons why you have to listen to another person. Many times there's legitimate use of authority, use of power, and sometimes it's illegitimate. If you don't have the power or authority yourself, you may borrow someone else's name or authority, right? Sort of like the time that my wife and I heard one of our kids distinctly telling the other two kids that mom and dad said to come inside. I look at her, I said, did you tell them to come inside? Nope, I didn't. But it worked. Why did it work? Because they had borrowed the authority, illegitimate as it was. They borrowed that authority. Authority by proxy. One of the issues that becomes a major, major theme in the Old Testament, and we see it begin to develop here, and it will hit a climax point at a few different places that we'll see this morning, is who is the Lord and who has the right to speak for the Lord? Who is Moses? Who is Aaron to look at another person and say, you must do this? Who are they? And they'll get pushback initially from Pharaoh, but then they get pushback really all throughout the Old Testament. Who has the right to speak? Pharaoh doesn't recognize the authority of Moses or Aaron or even Yahweh himself, God himself. Who is Yahweh that I should listen to him? And who are you guys? Moses, the fugitive? In fact, the Israelites even began to question whether Moses and Aaron have the right to speak to them and to tell them what to do. Just to catch us up in the story, God's promised deliverance for his people. The Israelites are slaves. They're in Egypt. The Lord has a plan to make good on his promise to bring them out. And the plan looks like it's going to work. God meets with Moses. He says, deliver this message. The Israelites are going to listen to you. And the Israelites do. They're encouraged. They're excited. God's up to something. He's doing something. Good news, right? But then Pharaoh rejects Moses and Aaron's message, and harsh penalties rain down on the Israelites. And we left off last week looking at, because of their tribulation and the difficulty they were going through, they said they couldn't even hear it. They were broken and hurting and despairing. And they didn't listen to Moses. Verse 9 says, because of their broken spirit and harsh slavery, the conditions had become such that they didn't really hear Moses anymore. So the Israelites are having trouble listening to Moses and trusting the Lord. Yahweh, of course, isn't deterred by this plan. Pharaoh isn't listening to him. And so Moses turns to the Lord and says, why are you doing this? It's not working, God. You told me to go say this, and ever since I did that, situation has only digressed. It's only gotten worse. What are you going to do? The Exodus account is interesting because it turns into, it's not so much that Israel is running away from the slavery of Egypt as they are being evicted out of Egypt by Pharaoh eventually. And it's more like the Lord puts a lasso around them and drags them out of Egypt. And even when they get to the wilderness, they're trying to go back to Egypt. What we have in this section here, it's really a summary and a retelling of some of the story. And then right here in the middle of verses 14 through 25, We have what may appear to us as an out of place or out of sorts genealogy. So in verses 10 through 12, or 10 through 13 rather, we have an explanation, a summary. This is what happened. Conversation between Moses and the Lord and a summary statement. Then in verses 26 through 30, we have a summary statement and a conversation with Moses and the Lord. And then right here in the middle, we have this genealogy. Now, if you're visiting here with us today, you're like, great, I popped in on the week for the genealogy. So-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so. Is that how this goes, right? We don't use the term begat a lot anymore, but if you're accustomed to the old King James, you'll know that's familiar. Now, some of you probably love genealogies. Most of us don't care about your genealogy, though, truthfully. Right? Just me? No, I think it's fairly universal. Most of us aren't all that interested in a list of names unless what? Unless we're on the list, right? Like, how does this affect me? Where am I in this? And we come to some of these genealogies in the Bible, and you come to a place like Book of Chronicles or Numbers, and it's just chapter after chapter after chapter of names. And you think, am I reading the Tel Aviv phone book here? What is this, and how does it affect my life? And page after page, it can become a little bit mind-numbing for us because we don't have any real connection to that. Now, if it's your family, you may read it with a little more interest, right? Somebody's put together the long family tree. One of my relatives a few years ago did some major research on where we came from, and they're explaining all this, and I have to be honest, I'm glazed over. You know, after about the second generation back, I'm like, yeah, I never met them. I don't really know who they are. What's for lunch? But they're into it, and I'm happy for them. On top of that, a lot of these names aren't really familiar to us, right? You read some of these, and we don't really know how to pronounce them. It's not like it says John Smith had a son named Jacob Smith who married a girl named Sarah Stewart. Now, I'm trying to use the most generic names possible here. If you happen to be visiting with us today and I hit your name, you may want to listen close. I think it's from the Lord because I didn't know you were going to be here today. God's speaking to you. It's hard for us to really groove out on a genealogy that doesn't have any connection with us. So what's up with the genealogy right here in the middle of the section? What is going on? Have you ever written a letter to someone and you're making a point or you're restating a case, and then all of a sudden, right in the middle of it, you start telling them about your family history or in a conversation? You're telling a story, you're recounting something. Have I ever told you about my great-grandfather? And it's totally lost on us because we don't write and communicate in this way. But what I want to try to show you this morning is that this was not foreign to how literature would have been communicated. And a lot of what I'm going to say stands on the foundation of, I believe Moses is the author at this point. And I believe Moses is writing this down, and he inserts this genealogy right here in the middle in order to validate and authenticate his own authority because of some of the later things that would happen. It's important that we see this idea of where Moses and Aaron came from, and particularly their connection with the tribe of Levi, the tribe that would be the priests. I think it's quite intentional. It's not an add-on. That's a by the way. It's very much built into the structure. So what I want to try to show you this morning is there's something in this passage, in it's a literary device that's commonly used in the scripture, and hang in there with me this morning as we talk through what this is. There's something called a chiasm, or sometimes you'll hear chiasm. And basically, a chiasm is simply this. It's when the main point is in the middle, not at the beginning. We typically write in a way to say we have a topic sentence, a thesis sentence, and then we have supporting sentences, right? Sometimes in the Bible, what you have is you have lead-in material, you make your point, and then material that mirrors the argument that you just made. It's called a chiasm because it looks like this. The Greek letter chi looks like a big X. I made that slide myself. Is everybody impressed? Amazing artwork. I know. I'll let you process that for a minute. It's called a chiasm because its structure is around this idea that the central focus. And so what we have going on is a statement is made, another statement is made, the main point is the genealogy, and then another statement made, and it backs out. Here's how it works out in our particular passage. In chapter 6, verses 10 through 12, Moses is speaking, and he says, I can't go because I'm a man of uncircumcised lips. That's an important phrase. At the very end, Moses again says, I can't go because, guess what? I'm a man of uncircumcised lips. So it's bookends to this passage. In the middle, Yahweh, the Lord, makes a statement, you will go. It's a summary statement of what's going to happen. On the other end of the genealogy, the Lord again makes a summary statement, you will go, in verses 26 and 27. So right here in the middle, we have this genealogy. This is why Moses and Aaron not only can go, but must go, because they are the legitimate authority that's from the tribe of Levi. They are God's representative. Right here in the middle of this story is a genealogy. We use chiasms sometimes in the way that we speak. We may not realize that's exactly what we're doing. Kevin DeYoung points out that we use these sometimes in English. A couple of familiar statements. You know them. When the going gets tough, what? The tough get going. Where's the point of that? It's right in the middle, right? When the going gets tough, the tough get going. And there's structure, right? There's parallel, the first part and the last part. They kind of make this X shape, right? John F. Kennedy's famous line, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So there's a build in, the point, and a build out. We use statements like this sometimes. So in the Bible, a lot of times what you have are these chiasms that are embedded into the narrative, and sometimes they'll be chapter upon chapter upon chapter. It's easy to see it when we've got one little statement, right? One little sentence that we can break down and see that. It may be a little bit more difficult for us to spot, you know, when it's chapter after chapter after chapter, but this is what's going on in these particular verses, these 20 verses here in chapter 6. So the emphasis is built into the symmetry of where this genealogy actually occurs. Now, I told you that Moses, part of what bookends this section is Moses' statement, I can't go because I'm a man of uncircumcised lips. There's a couple of different ways that we can understand that. It could refer to Moses' condition, which caused him to not be a good public speaker. He could have been stuttering. Maybe he had trouble finding the right words. I think many of us can identify with that, right? Many people's worst fears, you're handed a microphone and have a room full of people. You would lock up. You don't appreciate that. You wouldn't like that. Perhaps that was Moses. He just didn't enjoy getting up in front of people. Perhaps he actually stuttered. He had some sort of a speech impediment that did not allow him to speak clearly. We don't know exactly. So he could be referring to that. I'm of uncircumcised lips. I can't do this because I'm hindered in some way. I think more likely, though, what he's probably referring to, because of the way this structure is built, I think he's saying, I'm not holy enough for this job. I think that's what he's saying. And it's very much parallel to like the prophet Isaiah, when he gets this vision of the Lord. And Isaiah says, woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips. I think this is parallel to what Moses is saying. I'm a man of uncircumcised, unclean lips. I can't do this. You ever feel like you're not spiritual enough to speak for the Lord? I think we all do at some point. I'm not good enough to speak for God. I think this is Moses' condition. So what's the answer to Moses' uncircumcision of lips? Well, the answer is God has this for you because you're of the tribe of Levi, and I've picked them as my representatives. We'll flesh that out a little bit this morning. So Moses, he goes and delivers this news The Israelites' burdens have increased, not decreased. He takes his complaint to God, and God says we're going to do the same thing over again. We define that as insanity, right? Do the same thing, expect different results. It's not insanity when you're dealing with God, though, to do the same thing because God said so. The insane part would be to disobey God at that point because God said to go and God said to do it. So let's jump into this particular section. I want to read it all for us so that we have it in our minds. And hopefully now you'll read it and you'll see a little bit of this structure is probably set off by its own paragraph, verses 14 through 25, if you're reading a Bible that breaks down paragraphs. Chapter 6 and verse 10. So the Lord said to Moses, "Go in, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the people of Israel go out of his land." But Moses said to the Lord, "Behold, the people of Israel have not listened to me. How then shall Pharaoh listen to me? For I am of uncircumcised lips." But the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a charge about the people of Israel and about Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the people out of Israel, out into the land, out of the land of Egypt. These are the heads of their fathers' houses. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. These are the clans of Reuben, the sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. These are the clans of Simeon. These are the names of the sons of Levi, according to their generations, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, the years of the life of Levi being 137 years. The sons of Gershon, Libni and Shimei, by their clans. The sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel. The years of the life of Kohath being 133 years. The sons of Merari, Mahli, and Mushi. These are the clans of the Levites according to their generations. Amram took his wife, Jochebed, his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses. The years of the life of Amram being 137 years. The sons of Ishar, Korah, Nephag, and Zikri. The sons of Uziel, Mishael, Elzaphan, and Sithri. Aaron took his wife, Elisheba, the daughter of Aminadab, and the sister of Nashon, and she bore him Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. The sons of Korah, Asir, Elkanah, and Abisaph. These are the clans of the Korahites. Eleazar, Aaron's son, took as his wife one of the daughters of Putiel, and she bore him Phinehas. These are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites by their clans. These are the Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, "Bring out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt by their hosts." It was they who spoke to the king of Egypt about the bringing out of the people of Israel from Egypt, this Moses and this Aaron. On the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Lord said to Moses, "I am the Lord. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you." But Moses said to the Lord, "Behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. How will Pharaoh listen to me?" Well, that's a mouthful to read. I've told you before, if you're not really sure how to pronounce those names, just say it fast and confident, because nobody knows the difference, right? Some tough names. It's tough for us to really put ourselves into a genealogy. But what we're going to see is there are all kinds of little interesting tidbits in this genealogy. We're going to look a little bit at the Levite family. And what you're going to see is that the Levite family tree is gloriously messy. I think some of us think maybe we can't represent or serve the Lord because our family's a mess. Our extended family, perhaps. But what we're going to see in this family tree, in this genealogy, there's some messy people and some messy things. So we're going to pick a few of these characters that we know something about, and we're going to talk about these guys. A lot of times, genealogies in the Bible are serving a very specific purpose. Sometimes it's just to record the names in order to get us to the messianic line. Sometimes in a situation like this, it's to record the rightful priest, the priestly line, the line of Levi. It's rare in the Pentateuch, in the Old Testament first five books, it's rare for Aaron to be mentioned first ahead of Moses, even though Aaron is the older brother. Why is it that way? Because Aaron is shown to be the great high priest. He's the original priest where the priestly line would come from. And that's what we see stand out in this passage. So we're going to pull a few of these characters, and I want to tell you their stories. And I think you're going to enjoy learning a little bit about some of these guys. Some of the passages in the Bible we were talking about in our equipping hour this morning. Have you ever, most of us at some point, you've probably read most, if not all, of the Bible. And then sometimes you hear a story and you kind of look at the binding of your book and go, is that in the Bible? You may do that a couple of times this morning as we briefly take a sketch of some of these guys' lives. Yes, it's in the Bible, and yes, the genealogy includes it. Let's start with Levi. Levi, a defender and or a deceiver. Here's the story of Levi in Genesis 34, and then he's mentioned again in Genesis 49. He's one of the sons of Jacob, and he, along with his brother Simeon, they go out and they rescue his sister, their sister, Dinah, from this evil man named Shechem. Shechem had taken Dinah against her will, and he had raped her, and he wanted to then take her as his wife. Shechem's from a very powerful family, and they said he really wants her to be his wife. And so we want to make a deal with the Israelites so that this man can take this woman as his wife. And what we'll do is we'll set up an agreement and we'll come into a free trade agreement of sorts with one another. This marriage will be the union between the Hivite people and the Israelite people. And they said, name a bride price. Name what you want for us, because Shechem has a lot of resources and he really wants this girl. And they say, okay, here's our deal. We can't enter into covenant with you because your men are not circumcised. So if you will circumcise all of the males of the city, then we will give you Dinah to be Shechem's wife. This is in the Bible, people, promise. Genesis 34, read it. They said, we'll give you this daughter to be your wife if all the males are circumcised. Now, as a footnote, if you're a man in the city, you'd probably ask Shechem, is she really that awesome? Right? Is this worth it, man? Other fish in the sea, brother, right? They agreed to the terms. Levi and Simeon, though, had other plans up their sleeve. They waited until the third day after the men are recovering from this procedure, and they come with their swords and they kill all the men of the city, and they conquer the city. Jacob's upset with them, their father. He says, you've brought trouble on me and you've made me stink to the inhabitants of the land. And you have to love Levi's response at the end of this. Unfazed, he said, should he treat our sister like a prostitute? He says, stood up for what's right. Later, we'll see that there's a curse that's handed down on Levi because of the way he sinfully handled his anger in taking on this vigilante role and enacting his justice. Genesis 49. Next time we really meet the tribe of Levi is here, but it's not telling us anything about Levi. It's just laying out the tribe. The next time that we really meet the tribe of Levi is after the golden calf incident, where Moses calls them out and says, who's going to worship the true God? And the Levites all step forward, and Moses arms them to go enact capital punishment against those that didn't worship the golden, or that did worship the golden calf. Levi would become a key figure. He would become a figurehead, and his tribe would be used. Levi, defender? Was he a deceiver? Was he impetuous? Some good and some bad, right? Interesting character. How about Amran and Jochebed? Amram and Jochebed. In verse 20, It should be an N. My autocorrect was not pleased with me this week as I was trying to get some of these names right. I missed that one. It's Amram with an M. Verse 20 says, Amram took his wife Jochebed, his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses. Now, wait a minute. This was a match made at the family reunion. We go, did I read that right there in verse 20? Yes, you did. Yes, you did. He took his aunt to be his wife. Maybe very disturbing to many of us, right? This is one of the reasons why I really believe in the authenticity and the integrity of the Bible. Moses is recording this, the same guy that would record laws against this in Leviticus 18 and 20. And he's writing it down saying, hey, this is my family history. Yeah, it's a little messy, right? Now, in fairness, there was no law that was handed down at this point against marrying your aunt. But, nevertheless, it stands in one document which would later condemn this behavior. But in the timeline, we're not there yet. So there's no indication that this was illegal yet. But most of us would recognize that's not good practice. It's not cool to do that. But there it is, right there in the Bible. This whole section, this genealogy, is written by Moses, and this is his response. So Amram and Jochebed, and I tried to actually look at a little family chart, you know, one of those little things. I never can figure out who's what to me in family relationships because it gets messy really quickly. And I was trying to figure out, apart from being his mom, what exactly is Jochebed to Moses? Would that be his great aunt? I don't know. Some of y'all can figure that out and let me know. It's got all the earmarks of authenticity. This is not a redacted document that's cleaned up. You wouldn't write this in. He's just laying out the truth. This is the truth of the tribe of Levi. This is where we came from. This is my family history. Another guy, Korah. Korah was a cousin of Moses. He's mentioned here also. He's a cousin of Moses, and he is forever known as the man who was swallowed up by the ground. Now, it's just not always a good thing when you get your name in the Bible, right? It's not always good. It's another one of those stories that's really interesting, and I'd love to come back to this. In fact, we will come back to this one day in the future, and I just want to tell you the story and show you the story of Korah in Numbers 16. This is fast forward a little bit down the road. The Israelites have left Egypt, and they've just found out, hey, you're not going into the promised land. You're going to wander around for 40 years, and you're all going to die. That information didn't always go over too well with everybody, as you can imagine. Korah rebels against Moses and says, who gives you the right to speak for God? And they basically arrange a showdown, and the Lord says, have your men bring their censers, little fire pans, before the Lord tomorrow. I'm going to have my priest, Aaron, come, and we're going to see what happens. 250 of them that Korah had incited to rebel against Moses. And again, it's the idea of who gives you the right, Moses and Aaron, to represent God? And the answer is, of course, God gives them the right. So what happens that next morning as they come out? Fire comes down from heaven. It not only lands in the fire, the little censers, the little fire censers that they had, but it actually consumes the men themselves, 250 of them dead. Interestingly, Korah wasn't with them when this showdown happened. So Moses and Aaron go and find Korah. He's at his tent. He comes out and they have this confrontation. And the Lord says, back up. Moses pleads with the Lord. The Lord says again, back up. And they do. And the ground opens up, swallows Korah, his tent, his belongings, and his family, and it closes back up. Now, can you imagine being there? You're looking in a straight line, and there's a crowd gathered around. You're watching this man and his little camp, his little setup. All of a sudden, it disappears. The ground closes back up, and you're looking straight across. And you see the people on the other side of the circle. It's an amazing event. Absolutely amazing. Leviticus 16, I can't help but think of that scene in Return of the Jedi where the ground eats the people, right? But there's no Jedi that's going to save Korra from this one. Ground opens up, swallows him. In God's kindness and providence, you'll read in many of the Psalms, it has a little inscription that says, the sons of Korra. And the Lord still uses the sons of Korra, even after this event, even after the legacy of Korra. He still uses them to write many of the Psalms that we enjoy and have to even today. Korah. What about Aaron? Aaron got it right, right? Surely Aaron, the guy that met with God. Well, Aaron had his own moments, didn't he? He's the confused goldsmith, or could we call him a godsmith? After the golden calf incident, Moses is up on the mountain. We'll get to this one year in Exodus, so I won't tell you the whole story right now. Moses is up on the mountain. He's meeting with God, receiving the commandments that he's going to walk back down the mountain and deliver to the people. This is how you're going to set up your place. They've finally gotten away from Egypt. They're beginning to adjust to life at the mountain of God with Yahweh. And they hear, Moses hears this rumble, this noise, activity down below. And he goes down. And Aaron and the people have crafted this golden calf, this golden image, and said, this is the God that brought you out of Egypt. Moses is on the mountain receiving commandments that says, don't have any graven images. Directly in contrast. I love this account that we have in Exodus 32 because Aaron tries to play it off. And it cracks me up every time I read it. Moses confronts Aaron, says, how could you do this? Aaron says, so they gave it to me, meaning their gold and jewelry. I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. It's the craziest thing. Yeah, look at this. Can you believe that, Moses? How does Moses respond to that? Moses, again, I believe Moses is writing the Pentateuch. At the very end of the chapter, it says, then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf, the one that Aaron made. Right? It's like, not buying it, Aaron. Not buying it. No, you made this. You did it. This is our great high priest, the one who's supposed to represent God to us. And here he is, before this thing even gets off the ground. He's already making an idol. What a mess. What a mess. Well, his sons would do a better job, right? Nadab and Abihu. Not really. Eleazar would end up being a great priest. But the first two didn't do so well, and they didn't actually make it very long. Strange fire in a short service. In Leviticus chapter 10, we have recorded for us this strange thing. Strange fire in Leviticus 10. Unauthorized fire, your Bibles may say, in Leviticus. Now, this was the moment they've been waiting for. It was their big priestly duty. They finally had an opportunity. Finally had an opportunity to serve the Lord. They've been training their lives for this. Now, we don't know exactly what this strange fire or unauthorized fire was. It could have been the wrong offering, offered at the wrong time, on the wrong altar, something completely foreign to the process that God had not prescribed. We don't know. What we do know is they decided to introduce something that wasn't supposed to be there at a time when it wasn't supposed to be there. They kind of ventured out on their own and they started freestyling a little bit and said, we got an idea for how to make this process go a little better. The Lord wasn't looking for improvements on the sacrificial system. He was looking for priests to follow out his commandments meticulously, exactly as he said. So we don't know exactly what they did, but we do know how it turned out. They struck dead, and they didn't last very long. It says that Aaron wasn't even allowed to mourn the loss of his sons. Moses says, don't mourn for them. They didn't treat me as holy. I will be sanctified before all the people. I will be glorified. They made a mockery of God's holiness. God's dead serious. He's dead serious even today. We forget this sometimes, right? A couple years ago at a shepherd's conference, a big pastor's conference out in California, Al Mohler was speaking to a room full of pastors, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 pastors gathered up. And he looks at everybody and he says, you know, one of the greatest miracles of your preaching ministry is that you survived last Sunday. And he meant in the sense of you lived through it. You spoke for God and God lets you live. What? Deuteronomy 4:33, Moses says, did any people ever hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire as you have heard and still live? People heard from God, but it usually ended up with their death. We minister today and we speak on behalf of God, and it's amazing that we live through the experience. God's that serious. We forget that sometimes, don't we? God's so gracious and kind to us. Don't forget, folks, the wonder of being able to walk casually into a service like this. Sometimes we walk in with our hearts a million miles away from the Lord. And we sing songs that maybe are just programmed in our head and we aren't really engaged in our hearts and lives. We come into contact with divine truth and we're able to walk away from it. It's an amazing experience, and it's the grace of God that we live through encountering God. He's made a way for us to do that, that we'll celebrate even in just a little bit through Christ. Well, the story ends on a high note. And this is really where Moses is trying to get us, is to Phinehas, this zealous priest. We have his story recorded for us in Numbers 25. Phinehas is a celebrated character, especially after Numbers 25. The people, they are enticed and they've been dragged away and they're worshiping Baal. They're having relations with the daughters of Moab and Midian. They're dealing with this issue at the court of the temple. And then a man blatantly brings a woman from Midian, parades her by, and goes into his private quarters in broad daylight. Phinehas stands up and leaves the meeting, grabs his spear, and he goes and kills both of them. And he's celebrated for this. He finds the man in his chamber, and he spears through. The Bible says that the wrath of God was turned back. He's celebrated in the Psalms, Psalm 106, and other places for what he did. Now, we need to talk a little bit about some application of this, because I don't want you going out and killing folks as a result of listening to this particular sermon. If you brought your spear with you today, please leave that in your vehicle secured. We don't need those. This was a different day and age, and we'll talk a lot about that when we get to some of the laws that are spelled out in the book of Exodus. But the passion for God and his holiness and his glory, I think, is what we need to imitate and take with us. We have to remember the story that's being built. There's a Levitical priesthood that is preserved, and it's to allow man access to God. The imperfection of this family shows us that we needed a better priest, right? We have this Levitical priesthood, and it's checkered. It's littered full of kind of savory characters, right? There's a little bit of embarrassment even that we find in these genealogies. Sure, there's some high spots and bright spots, but there's also some things that we would rather just read past. But then we look to Christ. We look to the one who came from a fundamentally different priestly line. This is why it's so important what we learn in Hebrews chapters 5 through 7. Jesus didn't come from the line of Levi. He came from the line of Melchizedek as a priest. He's the greater priest. He's the highest of the high priest. He's not riddled with this type of history. He came from a different history, a different line. Jesus came. He's the better priest. He offered the better sacrifice at the better altar. And therefore, it's of invaluable and infinite worth, the sacrifice that Christ made. One of the things about the temple and the tabernacle that Hebrews plays out a lot is it had to be done over and over and over and over and over again. Like the grain offering that we were talking about in the Psalm this morning. It had to be offered and offered and offered and offered. We don't come today to offer more sacrifices. We come to recognize the sacrifice that Jesus made on our behalf. This whole Levitical system, it's all pointing to Christ. the better, the greater high priest who would make the better, greater sacrifice. Today we aren't here to celebrate how we can trace our lineage back to Aaron or Eleazar or Phinehas or anybody else. We're here to celebrate the fact that we are adopted into the royal family of God by the sacrifice and by the priestly work of Jesus Christ. This leads us into our time to celebrate the Lord's table today, and how fitting it is that we will remember the gospel message made visible for us through the Lord's table.